Rob Walsh likes to eat. He likes to cook, and he likes to write about food. He's the restaurant critic of the Houston Press now, but he has also been an occasional commentator for this program. Walsh has won the James Beard Award twice, once for a piece he wrote for us about spam. That essay, as well as many others, have been published in his new book. It's called Are You Really Going to Eat That? Reflections of a Culinary Thrill Seeker, and Rob Walsh joins us from the studios of KUHF in Houston, Texas. Rob, what a pleasure to talk to you again.
Boy, great to be on the show again, Leanne.
It is. I've referred to you as the Indiana Jones of food writers.
And I have gotten a lot of mileage off of that comment, Leanne.
So listen, tell us, what was it that got you interested in becoming a culinary Odysseus?
Oh, come on. Who wouldn't be interested in flying around the world and eating food? I mean, I don't know. I just assume everybody wants to do that. Certainly I did. I was reviewing restaurants in kind of an unusual way, I guess, in Austin, Texas, and American Way, the in-flight magazine of American Airlines, invited me to do some pieces for them. And so I had to sit down and think about where would I like to fly to and what weird things would I like to eat there.
Mm. And, but food has been a part of your life. Your maternal grandmother was a great cook, and didn't you start out with your dad, who was a deer hunter, and it was you that ended up kind of making something out of the deer?
Well, yeah, that's true. But, you know, really, and the truth is my dad was also a restaurant purveyor. His career when I was a kid was calling on restaurants and selling them general foods products. So I traveled around with dad and called on restaurants and went and saw restaurant kitchens when I was, you know, I guess I was 5 or 6 when we first started doing that kind of stuff. But mom didn't really like to deal with the pheasant and the venison and all that stuff that was in the freezer. And so I realized that here were these gourmet ingredients that I just had free reign over, so I did all sorts of things with them.
A perfect Sunday morning essay appears in the book. This was originally published in 1993. It's called The Ultimate Cup of Coffee, and it has to do with your exploration of Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee. And you write, like, despite the fact that there are bags of it at Starbucks and our local food boutiques and every coffee bar from Boston to San Francisco Bay offers cups of it, what we are drinking is not really the real thing. Explain.
Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee comes from a large area at the top of the Blue Mountains of Jamaica. And I had the joy of doing a cup tasting with a taster there. We tasted batches from, I guess, 6 or 7 plantations in the Blue Mountains. 5 of them tasted like, you know, just kind of average, ordinary coffee. I mean, good coffee, but nothing special. But 2 of them were unbelievable. I mean, sort of chocolatey, fruity aromas. Just, I didn't know coffee could taste like that. But I said, well, hey, how can we just get these 2? And they said, oh, sorry, we mix them all together. So I realized that what I had thought of as Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee is actually a blend of some stellar coffees and some more ordinary coffees. So, of course, I set out to find a way to get just the good ones.
There's an essay in the book from 1997, and it's called Wild and Wilder, and it's about wild rice and the idea,
yes,
that what we sometimes buy in the grocery store as wild rice is not wild rice. And you went up to, was it the Ojibwe reservation in Minnesota to get?
Yeah, that's right. The wild rice that is cultivated in fields isn't being processed, according to the Ojibwe, it's being processed the lazy way. It comes out dark, dark black, and you cook it for 40, 45 minutes, and it still doesn't really open up and get tender the way wild rice, I mean, wild rice used to be much lighter. Every little grain looked like a little butterfly, and it was just nutty and delicious. But the cultivated wild rice producers tell me that the problem is that Uncle Ben's and the companies that sell wild rice blends, they want the wild rice as black as possible, because when people shake the little box in the grocery store and look through the window, the more black they see, the better a deal they think they're getting.
And it's harvested in a very interesting way, going out by canoe and finding the plant and kind of shaking the kernels into the canoe?
Yeah, in fact, what you do is you beat the it's a grass that grows all the way from the bottom of the lake And when it's ripe, it's like 6 feet above the lake. And you go out in a canoe and you bend it over into the canoe and beat it with the canoe paddle. And the rice, it shatters. It gives off its grains into the bottom of the canoe. So you come back with a canoe full of wild rice. That's the original harvesting method.
The people in your book are as interesting as the food in the book. And there's a profile of a cook who's also a convict. And he made you dinner. Tell us about him.
Benny Wade Cluess originally went to the Gatesville School for Boys in 1952, I think, and he was 15 or something. And he realized that the easiest duty in the prison was working in the kitchen, and everybody else was out and working in the agricultural fields, and he didn't want to do that. So he learned how to cook really well, basically, as a survival technique in prison. But he spent 40 years of his life in prison, and he spent the whole time cooking. The way I found out about him was he writes letters to the editors of food magazines and to food people, you know, asking for recipes and asking for help. So one of these letters got forwarded to me, and I was just so fascinated by it. I set up an appointment to go eat Benny Wade Cluess's cooking in Darrington Penitentiary here south of Houston.
What did he make for you?
Well, you know, there's not a lot to work with in prison. And the most fascinating thing was all of the ingredients were grown on the Texas prison farms. There's like 10 prison farms south of Houston, and they grow all of their own stuff. He made me chicken fried hamburger steaks that were made from cattle that was raised there at Darrington Penitentiary. He made me broccoli in a cheese sauce. Of course, he didn't have any cheese, so he had to make that out of flour and oil with a yellow food coloring. But when he put the broccoli into the pot, he said that you have to change your water when you cook broccoli because the first water brings out all the bugs. And that's not a problem we generally deal with when we cook with broccoli. And he showed me the bugs. There's one called a stinky Jim. He said, you crush this, it smells like a skunk, you know, so obviously you don't want to eat them. You know, really what he was doing, he was cooking the way people cooked on southern cotton plantations 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. The fact is, he is cooking on a southern cotton plantation because Darrington Penitentiary is surrounded by 8,000 acres of cotton fields. It's one of the last places in the world where cotton is still harvested by hand.
You've eaten a fruit called durian. It's a fruit that's not available in the United States. You ate it in Thailand. And this wasn't really a pleasant experience for you.
Oh, durian. Durian is so interesting. People ask me what's the weirdest thing I ever ate. And it's kind of ethnocentric to say that durian is weird because people all over Asia absolutely love the stuff. But durian is very unusual. It tastes custardy. It's like this yellow custard. It's just absolutely delicious, except that it smells like rotten eggs. And for a Westerner, it's a really difficult experience. It's hard to get it down, I'll put it that way. I mean, I really had to fight the gag reaction on this stuff. But, you know, it's funny. One of the Thai gentlemen that I was traveling with lives in Texas, and he said, you know, I understand how you feel because I cannot for the life of me choke down blue cheese. He said, blue cheese, I think, is the weirdest food in the world. And that comment caused me to start thinking about what makes food weird for us, you know? And so I got in touch with Dr. Paul Rosen at the University of Pennsylvania, who explained weird food in a way that I'd never thought about it before. And really, the idea is we eat some strange things because it's a thrill. And really, it's a form of thrill-seeking. And then some of these strange foods become a badge of a cult. I mean, durian, you know, becomes you're part of this Asian culture if you eat durian. You know, you're a real gourmet if you love blue cheese. The stinkier, the better. Dr. Rosen explained that the Eskimos have a putrefied whale blubber that serves the same purpose in their culture. And he says that there's something exciting about eating something which is, you know, to which we have an initially adverse kind of reaction. In fact, for pepper eaters, there is the phenomenon has been called mouth surfing, where you eat a whole bunch of chili peppers and actually get a high off of it.
Hmm. Rob Walsh is the restaurant critic for the Houston Press. His new book of essays is called Are You Really Going to Eat That? Reflections of a Culinary Thrill Seeker, published by Counterpoint. He joined us from member station KUHF in Houston, Texas. Thanks, Rob. Good eating.
Thank you, Leanne.
There's an excerpt with a recipe from Rob Walsh's new book on our website at npr.org.